Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America's high-tech titans are all over the immigration reform debate in Washington these days. And it's not farm workers they really care about. It's high-tech talent. They want the bill that emerges to allow a lot more of it to come in from abroad. The argument is America needs more STEM workers in science, technology, engineering, math, and those immigrants will rev up our economy. There is pushback. This hour on Point, the high-tech end of the immigration reform debate. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Are you in high-tech? Is your company hiring engineers from abroad? Do you see the need? Where are the tech-ready Americans? AWOL or getting squeezed out? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. You want to hear the sound of the high-tech lament and request? Here all the way back in 2009, it was plenty evident already, a Senate hearing on immigration in 2009. Here's Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates. He's asked by Republican Senator then Judd Gregg of New Hampshire how many more H-1B guest worker visas the country should avoid for this should award for this kind of talent. Gates' answer was an infinite number, literally. Here's Bill Gates.
My basic view is that the country should welcome as many of those people as we can get, because people of those great talents, particularly in engineering areas, the jobs are going to exist somewhere, and the jobs around them are going to be created wherever those uniquely talented people are. So even though it may not be realistic, I don't think there should be any limit.
Bill Gates of Microsoft, bring in an unlimited number. That's what he'd like anyway. Let's look first at the lobbying effort here today. We'll hear the arguments on both sides. Joining me from Washington right now is Eric Lipton. He covers lobbying on Capitol Hill for the New York Times. His story, co-written with colleague Somini Sengupta, on the heavy lobbying on the immigration bill coming out of Silicon Valley, ran in the Times this past weekend. You can link to it through our website, onpointradio.org. Eric Lipton, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
Give us a sense of the scale of the effort underway now from the high-tech industry, Silicon Valley, to put their stamp on the immigration reform bill.
I mean, what distinguished their effort was the access that they had to the Gang of Eight and their staffers, and they were able to review drafts of the legislation and make comments on it and, in fact, incorporate changes into it even before the bill became public. So they got much better access than any other interest group, and they were able to influence the outcome in terms of what they get in the bill.
The Gang of Eight being the senators, four Republicans, four Democrats who are cooperating on this at this point. What is it that Silicon Valley, American high-tech leaders would like to see in this very big bill? Most people are focused on sort of the other end of it. What do they want it there in their neck of the woods?
They wanted tens of thousands of additional with these H-1B visas that allow workers from outside the United States to come here for a certain amount of time and to fill the jobs that they claim that they've been unable to fill with American engineers. They also wanted to make it easier for those people, once they come to the United States, to move into green cards and become permanent citizens, essentially. So they basically just wanted to be able to hire a lot more people from overseas, and they wanted that to be part of the immigration bill, which most people think of as a way for undocumented immigrants to become, you know, legalized here or to increase border security, but they sort of made the bill their own.
These are smart folks. What kind of people are they picking up to help them make their case in Washington, and what kind of money are they spending on their efforts, Eric?
I mean, the thing that was really interesting about this was to observe how the Silicon Valley folks, the Googles and Facebooks of the world that traditionally haven't been that politically active, really hired up and hired some very sophisticated political operatives in Washington. And they also, you know, created their own nonprofit in which they could make, you know, undisclosed amounts of donations to. And they created, you know, they have advertisements running on television in eight states, including, you know, ads with a group by the name of Americans for Conservative Direction. I mean, who would think that, you know, that Zuckerberger and you know, the folks from Silicon Valley would be behind a group called Americans for Conservative Direction.
Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, of course, famous founder there.
Right, which is running ads in states like Florida to support the senator there that's been supportive of the provisions in the bill. So, I mean, they just have gotten much more sophisticated in the way they're going about trying to influence Washington.
Let's hear a little bit of that. This is a kind of muscular lobbying, not just in the back halls of Capitol Hill in this case, but right out in public. Here's a little bit of one of those ads. This group that you describe, Eric, Americans for a Conservative Direction. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is one of the supporters of this group, financial supporters. They've been running ads supporting politicians who are behind the Gang of Eight immigration reform package. One of those is Florida Republican Marco Rubio. And you don't hear any mention in this ad supporting him of the expansion of visas for Silicon Valley jobs, but it's part of the package and the reason for this group's support, listen to it here, of Rubio.
Border security on steroids. Tough border triggers and no giveaways for lawbreakers.
No federal benefits, no food stamps, no welfare, no Obamacare. They have to prove that they're gainfully employed.
Bold, very conservative. Stand with Marco Rubio to end de facto amnesty. Support conservative immigration reform.
Bold, very conservative, and it's the voice of Mark Zuckerberg and more. That's kind of incredible, Eric. Who's directing this effort? What kind of people do they have in their camp, Washington veterans, I assume, who are helping orchestrate this?
You really almost have to laugh at it that they can present that as a, you know, that the folks that are behind that, and you know it is. Some of the people that they've hired are Rob Jesmer, who is the former Senate Republican campaign director, and they also have on their board of directors is Dan Senior, who was in the Bush White House and was an advisor to Mitt Romney. I mean, they've hired some really, you know, pretty seasoned political types who know how to get a message across and to influence the public opinion in the United States. And you know, now again, these guys argue that this advertising campaign is not about their corporate interests; that it's them as individual executives who really care about undocumented aliens, you know, undocumented, you know, citizens in the U.S. And that they really are looking out for them, and that this is not about their corporate agenda. But it really overlaps in a way that makes it hard to believe that it's not.
Bold, very conservative, with Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn. And more putting up the cash to support those pushing the big bill, and within that bill, a lot more places for high-tech and engineering talent from abroad. Eric Lipton, standby in Washington. Samini Sengupta joins us right now from San Francisco, also with the New York Times, on the byline there with Eric with this big piece over the weekend. Samini, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You cover Silicon Valley and the high-tech industry. Why are they so invested in this facet of immigration reform, Samini?
Well, this is something that they have been pressing for many years, with the claim that they need as much talent as possible in science and engineering from wherever they come in the world. And one of the points that they have been making is people who are educated in U.S. universities often end up going back to their countries, most often end up going back to their countries, and they would like an easier way to keep them here and employ them in companies that range from, you know, the Intels and Ciscos and Oracles to the new Facebooks and Microsoft and Google and so on. And so they have been pressing for this for many years. They seem to have hit upon a ripe time politically where they can get what they want under the comprehensive immigration reform package.
So they're kind of jumping on the bandwagon there, but with lots of effort in Washington to make sure that what they want is in the bill. How's it looking so far? Are they getting what they're lobbying for, Samini? I mean, there's a long way to go here, but do the early drafts have what they want?
Yes, as Eric pointed out, they really were able to shape the earliest draft of the bill in a very unique way. And yes, they did get much of their wish list. Notably, they got an expansion, a vast expansion of how many temporary workers they can bring in from overseas every year, nearly a doubling of that number. They also managed to get an easier way, a kind of fast-track way for STEM graduates to get green cards, to get permanent residency, and they got something called a startup visa option. Entrepreneurs who promise to create a business here also have a special visa for them. So they did manage to get much of what they wanted. There is some language, some regulatory restrictions that they continue to battle against, and very quietly, I might add, and that will play out in the coming weeks as the Senate and then the House take this on.
Eric, I'm reading here that there's still some unhappiness in Silicon Valley because of measures that are still floating around that would require people to make the case that they need to hire from abroad, would require them to check in with the federal government on those hires and make sure that they post them for American citizens first. What about that, Eric?
Well, there are a number of senators that participated in negotiations that feel as if the H-1B visa process has been abused in recent years, and they wanted to demand that there be provisions in there that they not essentially just be bringing in foreigners at lower wages to replace American workers. And so those provisions, some of them did end up getting included in the bill, and they don't like them, and they're seeking to get them removed. So that is a lobbying effort that is still going on as we speak.
So, but to this point, I know we've got to let you go here, Eric. Does it look to you like Silicon Valley is feeling its oats, like they're playing with the big boys and succeeding so far on this immigration track?
I mean, there have been a few examples in the last year or so where evidence of their continued success at sort of flexing their muscle in Washington. And I think it's just an industry that's growing up politically and starting to show that it can get its way. And so, you know, we'll see if this bill does make it through the Senate and then, you know, what kind of reception it gets in the House. But so far, they've made a lot of progress.
The premise is this country needs more science, technology, engineering, and math talent, STEM talent from abroad. It's being pushed very hard right now by high-tech Silicon Valley. Eric Lipton covers lobbying on Capitol Hill for the New York Times. Joined us from Washington. Eric, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the high-tech end of immigration reform. Silicon Valley and American high-tech pushing for more foreign talent to be waved into the country. Some American engineers and more pushing back. Somini Sengupta joins us from San Francisco. She covers technology for the New York Times. Let's bring in a couple more voices right here. Ron Hira joins us. He teaches public policy at the Rochester Institute of Technology. He's been researching the high-tech sector and its hiring of foreign workers for more than a decade. Testified before a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing just last month. Ron Hira, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Author of Outsourcing America. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Matthew Slaughter. He's faculty director at the Center for Global Business and Government at Dartmouth College, research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, served on the President's Council of Economic Advisors from 05 to 07. We invited Microsoft to take part in today's show. They directed us to Matthew Slaughter, said his views more or less track with theirs. Matthew Slaughter, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
What's the case that you and others supporting this expansion, dramatic expansion of H-1B guest worker visas make, Matthew? Let's hear it.
So it's ultimately about growth in the U.S. economy, growth in jobs and growth in incomes. When you look over the past many decades, almost all of the growth in worker incomes and jobs in America have come from innovation, and in particular from the STEM workers that we've been talking about. And in turn, those STEM workers in America, more and more over the past decades, we have relied on immigration as part of helping meet America's growing demand for talent. So today, foreign-born individuals in STEM occupations make up about a fifth of the workers with bachelor degrees and about two-fifths of those with advanced degrees. And so it's immigration that's been critical in helping meet America's growing demand for talent.
And your case, I guess the premise is that there's not sufficient homegrown talent to fill these positions, to expand these industries, Matthew Slaughter?
There's a lot of challenges with America's education system, and it's clear that for a lot of the highest talent, most innovative STEM occupations, formal training in STEM education is really critical. And one of the distinctive features of immigrants is they're much more likely to attain higher education, and in particular, higher education in STEM fields. So for the needs of a lot of the innovative companies in America, the immigrants that they've been able to attract and retain in America have a lot of the talent that they need.
Ron Hira in Rochester, New York, from Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg right on down. This is a common refrain, a loud refrain these days from Silicon Valley and beyond. What do you make of the case? We don't have the numbers. We don't have the talent. Our economy will benefit by bringing in tens of thousands more of these H-1B guest workers as part of the immigration reform package. What do you say, Ron?
Well, there's a simple way of measuring whether there's not enough workers, and that's looking at price signals. And the wages have been flat for more than a decade. And if we look at how the H-1B guest worker program is actually used, it's really bringing in ordinary talent, people with ordinary skills, at below market wages. And one of the symptoms of this you see is the top 10 H-1B recipients last year were all using it for outsourcing. So these are the offshore outsourcing firms, and they got more than half of the visas last year. So this is really about labor arbitrage, cheaper workers, and it's understandable that Bill Gates and others want to have a larger supply of cheaper laborers, but it goes to their bottom line. It's bad for both American workers as well as the American economy, and I would also say I think it's bad for innovation because what it does is it steers American students away from these occupations.
Samini Sengupta, outsourcing firms as the biggest recipient of H-1B visas, I think a lot of our listeners may not understand how that whole business works. These are to bring workers here to the United States. So what does it have to do with outsourcing, Samini?
Yeah, they do get large blocks of visas. As Ron said, they vary from year to year, but some years, including in the most recent year, they got nearly half of the total outsourcing visas granted. They tend to be both American companies and Indian companies. They bring temporary workers for projects at various American companies, banks, oil companies, even some software firms. And those workers, by and large, do their projects here, and they go back home. At the same time, these visas, the H-1B visas, are used by a variety of companies to actually bring people here and get them green cards. So roughly about 30% of these visas are used by those who studied here, got master's degrees or PhDs here, and who want to settle down. These H-1B visas are also used by them. So these temporary work visas sort of, you know, serve various functions, and that's why, in part, they are so contentious.
Ron, I guess the case that I've seen you and others make, I think, is that the consulting firms who bring in folks from overseas to use these and then go back home, what they take their what they've learned back with them to maybe India, let's say, and that is what facilitates outsourcing eventually. So come over on H-1B, learn the ropes, go back and do the work in India?
Yeah, so that's one function that they use. And then so there's something called knowledge transfer. That's the term of art that's used. And it's happening right here in Rochester at a major technology firm in product engineering, where we've got American engineers who have H-1B workers shadowing them, learning their jobs so that they can then take it back as the American engineers get laid off. There are other ways that these staffing firms use the visa for staff augmentation. And companies like Microsoft, of course, hire companies like Infosys and Tata Consultancy and have large amounts of shadow workers on contract. So it's not that Microsoft is lobbying just for its own hiring, but it's also using many of these staffing firms for their own, for example, desktop support.
Matthew Slaughter, there is talk that in this new immigration reform package, that face of H-1B visa use would be cranked back, would somehow be tamped down. What do you see coming? And is this part of what helps the U.S. economy, or is this just outsourcing jobs we could use here, Matthew?
So one of the things that's important is all the balance of peer-reviewed scholarship to date shows that when global companies expand in the rest of the world, that tends to support, not reduce, their activities back in the United States. So when we think about one of the values that immigrants bring to the U.S. economy, it's not just their ideas and innovative activity here. It's their connections to the world. And so today in the United States, where we still have an extremely damaged labor market, part of the policy challenge is a way to grow hopefully millions of new jobs that we need, but importantly, millions of jobs connected to the dynamism of the rest of the global economy. And immigrants tend to be really special in terms of having personal and professional connections to those fast growth markets.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean when you say we have an extremely damaged labor market. What do you mean exactly?
So in the aggregate, we still have high unemployment and underemployment. Now, when you look at STEM occupations, what you see actually is a very tight labor market. So in a lot of STEM occupations today, the unemployment rate is at or slightly below their many decade averages.
So I'm sorry, that's actually factually wrong.
This gets right to the heart of the argument. Supporters of expanding the access for highly educated foreign workers say we've got a shortage here. Opponents of it say, no, we've got plenty and we could have more. I want to try and work this out. Ron, what do you say about that point?
Well, look, the unemployment rates for STEM workers are about twice where they should be when we're at full employment. So Matthew Slaughter's wrong in terms of the data. I'm a little bit surprised that he would make that argument. The other point here is that these aren't highly specialized folks. And getting to something that Samini Sengupta said earlier, what the tech industry really lobbied for here was an increase in the base cap. So this is people that have no more than a bachelor's degree. They did not lobby for the advanced degree holders. So, you know, sort of the poster child that the industry usually talks about is an MIT grad or a Stanford grad who's being forced to go home. In reality, when you look at the political muscle that Eric Lipton talked about earlier, what they really pushed for was the base cap. People with no more than a bachelor's is where the increase in the H-1Bs would be. And they fought against any kind of wage floor increase. So they're still going to get a 20% discount if this bill gets passed.
And what would the numbers be, Ron? It's been 65,000 or so H-1B visas, given a year. They opened that window up. Those snapped up in no time. If this should go through, what would the numbers look like down the road, Ron?
Well, it could go as high as 205,000. So right now we're at 85,000, and it could go as high as 205,000 with the way the Senate bill is written.
Is that a big deal out of the whole American economy? I just don't know.
Yeah, it is, because you've got already about 600, nobody knows exactly how many, but you have about 650,000 H-1B workers here right now. You'd end up with probably about 1.2 or 1.4 million if the bill passes. Plus, you've got large flows of workers in IT and STEM coming in on L-1 visas. There's a whole alphabet soup of these visas. And so they're probably accounting for, 20 to 25% of all of the workers in IT. That has severely distorting impacts on the labor market in terms of both job opportunities as well as wages for American IT workers.
Matthew Slaughter, if it's the highly talented foreign STEM worker that's sought after here, why is it the base cap, the number of bachelor's degree holders that's being pushed, what the increase is being pushed for here? I mean, they may be great, but how do you know when it's just at the bachelor degree level?
Well, you don't know for sure. That's the serendipity of innovation. Part of what these companies need is access to a lot of great talent, both that created in America from native-born STEM workers who are here and immigrants. Part of what these companies are trying to achieve is that creative dynamism that allows them to create whole new products and processes, in fact, entire new industries that have supported growth in America. And I will come back to the data. This is really important, Tom. We can talk about data anecdotes, or we can talk about data distributions. And for public policy, the comprehensive data distributions are much more important. So if you look at the most recent data from the U.S. Current Population Survey, which is what the U.S. Department of Labor uses to construct the unemployment rate every month, right now, the unemployment rate for STEM occupations in America is about 2.5%. That's down from its crisis peak of about 4.5% in 2009. Okay. And that's about at its 20-year average. So that's one of many signals that exists in the United States today that the demand for STEM talent remains very high. And I'll point out that we have experience with higher visa cap levels in the United States. For a handful of years, including in the late 1990s, the H-1B visa cap was tripled to 195,000 workers. And that was, not coincidentally, a boom time in the U.S. economy. We had very strong growth in jobs and in incomes at all parts of the distribution of skills.
Ron, how about it? 2.5% unemployment in STEM jobs sounds low, sounds tight.
Well, the computer occupations is at 3.6% for 2012. I don't know whether he's looking at the monthly. We have to be careful about any kind of monthly data, which is pretty volatile. But if you take the average rate from 2012, We've got elevated levels of electrical and electronics engineers, 3.4%. We would expect about a 1.5%. So it's more than double the rate of unemployment in these major occupations where the H-1B is used, which is mostly in computer occupations and engineering occupations.
Ron here, Samini Sengupta, Matthew Slaughter, stand by. I want to get our listeners in here. Bob in Des Moines, Iowa is calling. Hi, Bob, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have concerns that this goes well beyond traditional high-tech industries. I read a story a while back about a large Milwaukee motorcycle manufacturer had an IT department of 125 employees. They laid every single one of them off and subcontracted the IT department. Subcontractor offers significantly lower wages, so the Americans can't work for such a low wage, and he ends up getting H-1B visas to fill the job with lower wage workers. It seems to me like we can go to all kinds of other industries, and it's not necessarily the Google, the Microsoft, or the Facebook, but it's everyday American manufacturers who can lay off IT workers and go to Infosys or another subcontractor. And I'm wondering if we have any provisions to protect us from that.
We'll pick it up. I appreciate your call. Matthew Slaughter, what do you say to Bob and his concern out of Des Moines?
So Bob's example is an excellent one of the dynamism of the U.S. labor market. For many, many years, it's been true that every hour that America is open for business, about 25,000 jobs in America are destroyed. So that's about 4 million a month. About that many are created each month as well. And STEM occupations are no different. The dynamism of the U.S. labor market of workers and companies matching and figuring out best use has been ongoing well before the financial crisis. It's true today. It will be true in the future. So one of the important things that Bob talks about is thinking about what's the right social safety net that we have for all workers in America when they've got these job displacements. But again, I'll stress that over the medium and long term, the only way that the U.S. economy has grown jobs and incomes for workers and their families is through innovation. And in particular, again, it's these STEM workers that have long been so critical for the innovative capacity of the American economy.
So you're saying, don't worry, it won't happen. You're saying it will happen. It does happen. but it may not feel good, but it's good for you?
So that's right. And I'm not saying that every one of those people in Des Moines wasn't feeling real economic hardship. That's why, ideally, a broad conversation about how to support workers in America would involve conversations about the social safety net and expanding and strengthening that in different ways. But again, I'll stress that over the medium and long term, where job growth comes from is from innovation. And again, where innovation comes from in turn is largely from the talented STEM workers that have been so critical for coming up with the new products, new processes, entire new industries.
Let's get Lee on from Boston. Hi, Lee. Thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you know?
Hi. I work for a very large technical firm. I actually work for other large companies like Oracle. And we have an outstanding problem. The reason why even the H-1Bs are insufficient for us, because we have such a shortage in terms of the talent that we can hire. A lot of companies, Facebook, Google, and a lot of, including us, we go into college campuses to try to actively recruit students, but there just isn't enough talent. And I think the biggest problem is just our education system isn't providing incentives for students to go into these hot markets. And I wish the government, or actually our restructure, think of it long-term and allow our students to get even free education so we can populate, get a lot more CS majors out. What are your thoughts on that?
Ron, I'll bring it to you. We just got half a minute before the break, but there's Lee. He's in the biz. They've got a lot of hires to make, and they just don't see enough in the U.S. Pipeline.
Yeah, so if this was really true, you'd see wages going way up, and they're really not. In fact, CS majors and degrees are up. They're below where they were in the 1990s because there's labor market signals going to students. Engineering degrees are up. And so we have an education market that's matched to the labor market. When the labor market sends signals, when wages go up, people vote with their feet, and then they major in those fields.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the high-tech end of immigration reform, Silicon Valley and American high tech, pushing for more foreign talent to be waved into the country. Somini Sengupta of the New York Times covers high tech out of San Francisco. She's with us today. Ron Hira at the Rochester Institute of Technology is here. And Matthew Slaughter, he is faculty director of the Center for Global Business and Government at Dartmouth College. So, Mimi, we've read in your newspaper, Tom Friedman, columnist there, saying, look, we need all the talent we can get. We should staple a green card to every diploma of a foreign student in an American university, particularly in science, technology, engineering, math. Is that the prevailing sentiment in your Silicon Valley neck of the woods, Samini?
Yeah, I mean, so as you've heard just in the last few minutes, the data can be used to tell all kinds of stories, and this is a very, very contentious subject, whether we need so many STEM workers from abroad. So just a couple of points. Yes, this meme of stapling a green card onto diplomas has been something that Silicon Valley executives and investors have been talking about for years. Now, it is true that across U.S. universities, there are very large numbers of foreign students in these fields. So in engineering, for example, master's and PhD students in recent years, nearly half are foreign students. And that's because, you know, the U.S. has some of the best universities, and the most ambitious students from around the world come here to go to college. And many of them, about 30% of them, end up staying here and working under these temporary visas and applying for green cards. And the immigration bill that we started talking about very specifically makes a provision that makes it easier for those people to be able to get permanent residence visas.
So pick this up, Samini. I mean, we've got a lot of tough response here online. People who, you know, largely American citizens saying, wait a minute, here's Donnie. He says, it's so much easier to have someone with an H-1B visa from abroad. It's like having an indentured servant. They can't work for another company while they're on that visa. I guess that's true. If I don't like them, I send them home. If they don't work 70 hours a week, I don't like them. They don't have family with them, so there's no family leave. I can pay them 50% of what a citizen costs. And then he's sort of channeling the Zuckerberg position here. He's saying, don't stop the H-1B program or I will give money to your opponent. What about that? There's a tough response view from one of our listeners, Samini. What do you say to it?
There are in the Senate bill provisions to raise the wages for the H-1B workers, and it makes it considerably harder for these outsourcing firms to bring in guest workers for temporary projects. It raises the penalties for them quite substantially, in effect allowing the Silicon Valley companies to continue to import foreign workers, but much harder for the outsourcing companies to do the same.
But I guess part of the concern here is that even if they're not with a consulting firm, if they're H-1B, there is competition. Matthew Slaughter looks at it as more horsepower for our economy. This listener takes it another way. Matthew, here's a listener on Twitter. Dave says, as an engineer, I can definitely say it's about cheap labor. Overseas firms provide a high-tech version of migrant farm workers. Matthew Slaughter, what do you say to that listener?
So a couple of things. One is when you look at the most recent U.S. government data and compare the earnings of U.S.-born and foreign-born workers in STEM jobs and control for educational attainment, age, where they work in the country, their wages are statistically the same. So the earnings of immigrants in the United States in these STEM occupations are the same as those of American workers. And my second point is I'll draw on my own industry, which is higher education. At the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, about 35% of my faculty colleagues are foreign-born. And Samini earlier mentioned the great strength of a lot of American universities. Well, over the many decades, part of what has made American higher education so strong is our openness to foreign scholars. And if I imagine a world where I don't have those 35% of my colleagues who are foreign-born here at Tuck, I guarantee you that the quality of the teaching for our students, my teaching, my research, would be much lower. And I think that's a very telling example that is true for a lot of innovation-intensive industries like the STEM occupations we're talking about.
Let's get our listeners right in here. Cheryl in Buzzards Bay, Massachusetts. Cheryl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Calling, my husband has been in the tech industry since 2000, and to echo the sentiments of Bob from Des Moines, he actually lost his job in a mass layoff in 2003, and the jobs were sent over to India. He currently works in the IT industry as a consultant and works either in tandem with or competitively with other consultants from other high-tech firms. And, you know, he comes home with stories about, again, the cheap labor from immigrant, or foreign-born workers that are working against them. But, you know, the quality is lacking, not willing to put in the kind of hours that, you know, he and his colleagues in his company are willing to put in, doing just kind of status quo, not going above and beyond, client relations not there because he does have to interface with clients. So that's definitely a concern for him. And on another note, the one talking about the person who brought up the idea of education, I work in a middle school, and I know our middle school teacher is actually in charge of instructing other science and math teachers in our area in STEM education and curriculum for STEM education. So that's happening at our school, and I know it's being taught to other teachers as well in our area.
Cheryl, I appreciate your call. Ron Hira, Cheryl's husband sees a lot of the talent coming in from abroad, but he's not necessarily impressed with the quality here. How do you interpret that? I mean, it's not easy to bring people in, so there's got to be a motivation, a reason.
Oh, the motivation is cheaper indentured labor. I mean, it is very easy. Let's be clear here. You've got 650,000 H-1Bs already here. It's not all that difficult, and thousands of employers bring them. Cognizant alone last year got 9,000 H-1Bs and hired almost no Americans. This is not a very difficult threshold. And let's also be clear, this is not a faculty position at one of the Ivy League, you know, top 10 universities. What we're talking about is ordinary skilled workers working at a bank in the back office on ordinary IT work that's already being done by Americans but is being taken over by guest workers. This is an intervention in the labor market by the government. It's employer-driven, and what they're doing is bringing in lower-cost labor to replace Americans or lower their wages. So I think it's pretty straightforward. And what you're really finding is the political imbalance here, where you've got the tech industry with hundreds of millions of dollars that they're spending both on lobbying but also on public relations. You really don't have anybody representing the American workers in this fight in a serious way. And you see this even in the comments to Somini's article over the weekend. If you actually read those comments, the overwhelming majority are very skeptical of what's going on with the arguments in terms of the tech industry because they know what's going on the ground floor in their own workplaces.
Let's go to David calling from Omaha, Nebraska. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah. I have a little bit of perspective on this from both my experience working in high tech in Silicon Valley about 10 years ago and working in high tech fields in other industries, banking and healthcare. I found that my experience with working with foreign-born H-1B workers was really no different than working with American workers in high tech. You know, it was 1090.
What do you mean by 1090?
10% of the workforce did 90% of the work. It didn't matter where they came from.
And do you think, do we need that flow? Do we need more of that flow for the U.S. economy to optimize, David?
No, I really think that there is just... in general, people that sit around and do nothing all day. I had a guy I worked with in Omaha that sat around and read the newspaper. I had people in Silicon Valley that, you know, updated whatever social media there was at the time or their RSS feeds. But I've also been through the process of hiring an H-1B worker in healthcare IT just recently. And you had to game the system. This was a talented person that we needed on our team that we wanted to keep, but he was junior. So we had to give him a promotion to keep him.
So there's just sort of the global nature of labor, is some great, some not, wherever you find it, and you're reaching out. We hear that. David, thanks. Martin in Arlington, Massachusetts. Martin, you're on.
Well, hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you see?
Well, first of all, I've been in IT for over 25 years, and for seven of those years I worked in outsourcing, and five of those I worked for IBM. I will tell you, some of the things some of your your folks have recently said make a lot of sense, is that, but let me explain how the IT industry works for outsourcing. IBM or Wipro or Oracle or any of these companies hire people from Pakistan and India and sometimes China for maybe $20,000 or $30,000.
You're talking abroad or people that they're going to bring here to the U.S., Martin?
People they're going to bring here.
Yeah, okay. H-1B.
And then they bill them out at about $50 to $60 an hour, which is equivalent to about $100,000 to $120,000 a year, is what they bill them at. Okay?
Yeah.
So you can see they're making about $80,000-$70,000 per person per year.
Yeah.
Now, guess what? You know there's a lot of 40- and 50-year-old programmers out there who don't have jobs. Why don't they have jobs? Because of ageism and because of the economy. Well, guess what? If we didn't import all these low-income young people, the ones that Facebook, when you think about Facebook, you don't think about them hiring 50-year-olds. You think of them hiring 25-year-olds.
Yeah.
Why do they want 25-year-olds? Same reason you do why you want 20-year-old waiters. They're cheaper. They want the young ones from abroad. They want to bring them here for a couple years, either to have them in their own little job or to outsource them. I mean, net effect is that people who are middle-aged who can't get jobs don't have jobs, or their wages are depressed 20 or 30% because these folks bring their wages down. I will tell you, after working at IBM, I have never once in my entire career in IT seen an employee who is an H-1B employee who had to be there. In other words, these folks didn't have special skills. They were just cheap. The only type of person that we have that's a special skill is someone who is a founder, you know, or an R&D senior executive who knows so much. These are not the types of people we're importing. Those are real H-1B.
But what about, you may have heard Matthew Slaughter say earlier, bring in this talent and it will muscle up American high tech and we'll all end up better off for it. What do you say, Martin?
Well, there's two issues here. There's a difference between if you're talking about a company that's Wipro, IBM, Oracle, these folks are outsourcing. Remember all those jobs that are going overseas?
Yeah, sure.
Well, when they come, what happens is the same companies that manage those jobs, like they'll try to manage a government contract or a huge contract to change some software, and that contract may cost $10 or $20 or $100 million. The only way they can justify doing the work to the business is if the labor to do the job, to get the job done, has to be done at a very cheap rate. Which means to get this incremental business, the only way they can do it is to hire cheap people, which means they don't want to have the Americans who can't get jobs employed.
And then there you are in the global labor market again. I guess this is about what we do with that. Martin, I want to get one more caller, and I'll take it to my guest, Sarah, in Andover, Massachusetts. Sarah, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. My daughter is in ninth grade, and she's very good in math, and she was interested in going into engineering, and the teacher discouraged the students from going into engineering because he said that by the time they graduate, they're only in ninth grade now, all the engineering jobs were going to be outsourced, and so he encouraged them to look into other fields.
Okay, Sarah, thank you very much. Matthew Slaughter, what do you do with that? I mean, even very open-minded Americans certainly want American students to be incented to jump into these fields, to do very well, Sarah's daughter and a whole lot of others. What does it mean if her ninth grade teacher is saying, don't bother, that work's going abroad?
So it's a great question. It kind of connects with Cheryl's comment about the work her middle school is doing on teaching students in STEM.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things about innovation, whether it's in high tech or in all kinds of other industries in America, is almost by definition, people can't predict the future. It's hard to know exactly where the new jobs and new industries are going to come from. But part of what maintains such strong demand in America for STEM workers is their problem-solving skills, their numeracy, their agility with data.
But we're structuring the future with these immigration reforms, are we not?
Well, hopefully we are in a good way, which is we're going to build the new jobs and companies and industries in America that allow us to create higher and rising incomes for Americans. There's no law of physics that America in the future has a lock on those good jobs at good wages. It comes back to something very early in the program that Bill Gates mentioned in his testimony. As the rest of the world is developing so quickly, their educational systems, dozens of countries have really improved the kind of education they're providing their young people, like Sarah's daughter.
Let me take it to Ron, if I may. Our time is so short. Ron, is Sarah's daughter's teacher in middle school right to tell her don't go to engineering because, you know, that's going to be done by workers from abroad?
No, I don't think so. I think if we get the immigration system right, I think there will be opportunities through innovation. But I want to say that the tech industry has really offered us a false choice. They've said that, as well as Matthew Slaughter here, they've said basically that the only way we can bring in the best and brightest from abroad and keep them here is by importing hundreds of thousands of cheaper indentured workers. I also want to make a couple quick points. One is the age discrimination one is terribly important. The unemployment rates really don't measure the underemployment that's going on in the field. And the other point, which is a little bit counter to what so many said earlier, is that the bill doesn't really address all the outsourcing that's going on, the cheaper outsourcing that IBM, Accenture, and Oracle do that have the same kind of business model that a Cognizant and Infosys. The bill doesn't address that at all.
Well,
and so they'll continue to be outsourcing hundreds of thousands of jobs this way.
We'll see how this goes. Here's a young listener on Facebook. Gordon writes, in talking about his generation of students, he says, give us the student loans and education grants, give us a company stateside, and we'll give you the economy strong. Samini Sengupta in San Francisco, what's your sense? Does Silicon Valley feel like this is going their way? They're going to get what they want in the immigration reform package eventually?
Yeah, I mean, this is still, early days for this package. And as everyone has pointed out, they got much of what they wanted, and they will continue to battle it out, both in the Senate and the House in the coming weeks.
Watch for that battle, along with the much bigger immigration debate, as all this rolls forward. Grateful to all three of you for being with us today. Samini with the New York Times in San Francisco. Sengupta, thank you so much, Samini.
Thank you.
Ron Hira at Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York. Ron, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Matthew Slaughter at the Center for Global Business and Government at Dartmouth College, Hanover, New Hampshire. Matthew Slaughter, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In this hour tomorrow, the sales tax and the internet. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.